sort, you know, asking for some kind of program where you can get some kind of assistance for people who were in severe need, you know, throughout the Delta and throughout the state of Mississippi. And this information was taken to Kennedy. And what happened is Kennedy summoned a socialist. What is the fellow who wrote the anti-apartheid plan?
Harrington?
No. That's not it. No. Okay, he went in and wrote the anti-apartheid program. But it was taken, well, Bob had met with this particular Bob Ramsey and Foreman, a lot of them, Annie Erringham, Paul, a lot of us met with him and laid it out, you know, what we were asking for. And he went back to Kennedy and came up and wrote the anti-poverty program. But it was blown completely out of context as to what was supposed to have been and what we had visioned would be. And my reason for not wanting it to come into Mississippi at the time was simply because I thought that it was going to do exactly what it did do, is help to destroy the movement itself. Because once you began to get people like myself out of the streets, then behind a desk, and around the conference tables, into a nice car, a nice house, a nice family, our commitment will automatically and immediately diminish. And it did. Whereas, when I was out there struggling and fighting, committed to the movement, I had to then become committed saving my job. I had gotten used to a different way of living, you know. Other people were working, and nobody was really then concerned about the issues. Right? And then, if you were still committed to being an activist, they developed the Hatch Act. Whereas you then became a federal employee, and anybody who then gets out and demonstrate, you become subject to the Hatch Act. Mm-hmm. And it destroyed it. It destroyed the movement. People who really began to benefit then from the poverty programs are persons who really didn't really need it. And I think the government reached its objective. And that's why I was against it. Mm-hmm. And I still am.
The, I was telling you, when we started up, Mrs. Palmer's visit to Duke, she turned some people's heads when she talked about poverty programs and having talked about trickle-down theory. You know,
sure.
I mean, by the time we got to Duke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but you can read about that, but to hear somebody like Mrs. Palmer just lay it on the line, like,
yeah.
she was great.
Mm-hmm. It didn't help. It sat people back 10 years, almost, itself.
Mm-hmm.
People that were out there and people who were inactive, you know, who were active in the community, who got jobs, you know. We've made it. And when those things were snatched out from under those people, they found themselves head over heels in debt. They couldn't feed their families, and they were forced to leave families. They destroyed families.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that. I guess, you know, I'm glad though I sort of stood out as a sort of thumb in the latter years of SNCC and the movement.
You talked about that. You thought that that began to happen when you and Willie sort of were the most vocal opponents of the. What did you do during the summer?
I worked.
In which project?
In the Greenwood Project. Mm-hmm. Just floating around, feeling useless. And I felt I was even more battle fatigued then because I'd been beaten severely.
And when did that happen?
Well, just before the Mississippi Summer Project, Willis Hollis, Curtis Hayes, no, Willis Hollis, Jesse, MacArthur Cotton, and James Black and myself, we were headed to Ohio to begin to train the students that were coming in to Mississippi that summer. Mm-hmm. James Black was driving. We left Greenwood, Mississippi, around 4:30, 5 o'clock that evening. We drove until just about 6 o'clock when we arrived at Starksville, Mississippi. Willie had classmates that he graduated from college with that lived in Starksville, and I had a girlfriend that I loved who lived in Starksville. But Willie wanted to go over and visit his friends, so we went to visit. That night, about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, we proceeded to go on to Atlanta. We were going to catch the bus in Atlanta. All of us were going to drive up as SNCC field secretaries or two. The meeting. We arrived, well, as we left Starksville, a car drove out behind us, 1956 black and white Mercury, driven by a white man, who began to drive almost bumper to bumper to us, like he was going to knock us off the road. We got to a place called Mayhew Junction. And the man turned off. We said, wow, this man has turned off. Well, you know, nothing was going to happen. All of us were afraid. Because by then, all of us had been shot at or shot or something like that, beaten. And we just knew this man was going to do something. As we approached the city limit, which is about 5 or 10 miles further up the road from Mayhew Junction, we saw this police light back down the highway, so let's pull over. And the man was coming to pull us over, Roy Elders, never would forget him, Highway Patrol.
E-L-D-E-R-S?
Right. Pulled us over and ordered us all to get out on the right-hand side of the car, with our hands in the air, and put our hands on top of the car. We did. He said, Jack, if one of these niggas move, I want you to blow their nutsacks out. And we looked back there then, it was the same man who looked to have been drunk that tried to run us off the road. He took the car keys, Roy Elders did after we went out, opened the trunk of the car. We had all of the literature on the Civil Freedom Summer Project. He said, oh! Look what we got. These are the niggas that are trying to change our way of living this summer. He said, oh, we got them, Jack. You're right. He said, okay. What we're going to do is call the sheriff and let the sheriff come pick up these other four niggas here and let him take them on into jail. You and I are going to take this other nigga who was driving with us, so you can show us where he tried to run you off the road. Who was James Black, who was a student at Tubular. So they put Black in the car with them, and the sheriff came, handcuffed us all, drove us to jail. And as they were booking us in, about 45 minutes later, they came back with James Black, Elders, and Jack, the civilian. Came back with him and looked like his eye was about to pop out, blood everywhere. And Fella said, look at your damn nigger friend here. He couldn't even stand up on his own 2 feet. He fell up all upside my car and hurt his eye. Look at him. Anyway, after then, they took us all upstairs and threw us in jail in the same cell. About 20 minutes later, we came up to the same cell, and they got me out. And Roy Elvis and another patrolman took me in the back of the jail, Columbus, Mississippi jail, and ordered me to run, pulled the pistol out. I said, no, sir, I'm not going to run. He said, yes, nigga, you are going to run. And I wouldn't run. The next thing I knew, I was hit with the butt of the pistol here. And it sort of dislodged his eye further here. I can't show his eye at all now. I remember falling down to the ground. I remember being kicked and beaten. Some kind of way they ordered me up. I don't know how I got up. I actually got through beating me. Willie said they could hear me screaming and hollering downstairs when he was beating me. And I crawled back upstairs and I just fell out in the cell. The next morning when I woke, when I wake up, they had taken all of us downstairs and beat us. The next morning, they handcuffed us together and marched us through town over to the FBI office to mugshot us and everything. And one of the things that they said was that they were fixing to take us to the Mississippi State Penitentiary.
There was an FBI office in Starkville?
Yeah. No, this is in Columbus. All this is in Columbus.
Okay. Yeah.
So they marched us through town in Columbus over to the FBI office with handcuffs on and came back and put us in individual patrol cars. Said, you niggas won't get a chance to change our way of living this summer. You go into the Mississippi State Penitentiary. So they took us out in the country to the gestures of the peace. And when we got out there, man, there were all kind of people out there, you know, farmers and stuff came later. We met in the back of the Justice of the Peace office. We really believed that their intentions were to hang us or do something with us. But they had us all five in the office, had us handcuffed, and had a sheriff in there watching us. And then the sheriff asked us, said, where are you niggas from? I said, sir, we're from Mississippi. We're all born and reared in Mississippi. He said, you're goddamn lying. You're goddamn lying. So all you niggas ain't from Mississippi because we know that we've trained our niggas better than this. We know our niggas. We know our niggas. You're not from Mississippi. So we said, yes, we are. So he took us back outside and handcuffed us around somewhere around the tree in the sun out there, about 100 degrees away. Brought us back in for some reason. And the phone rang. And the sheriff answered the phone saying, this is Judge Whitaker's office. He said, well, I can't accept no collect call, operator. He said, let me get the judge. So we went back there. We were all handcuffed to chairs and stuff. To move. Went back there and got the judge. The judge rolled himself out in the wheelchair and had a patch over his eye. He said, this is Judge Whitaker's. He said, oh, hell no, I can't accept no collect call, operator. He said, wait just a minute. So he put his hand on the phone. He said, do you niggas know anybody named any Dillon Worth? And all of us were together. Said, that's our attorney. He found us. And he said, oh, operator, I can't accept no goddamn collect call. Threw the phone on the hook and said, we got to get rid of these niggas. And rolled the stuff back. And I guess the district attorney or somebody, they came out and said, fellas, we were just deciding what we were going to do to Mr. Elvis, who was probably responsible for all this that happened to y'all, the beating and stuff last time. He said, we're going to let y'all go, but your car, you're going to have to pay for staying in jail overnight. You're going to have to get your car out of storage. He said, it's going to be $28 a jail fee, and $2.08 to get your car out of storage staying overnight. He said, it's going to be $30.08. And that's all we had, period, to our name.
They knew that?
They took our money. They had searched us. Mm-hmm. They took our money. And when we got across state line, Mississippi, into Alabama, we pawned the spare on the car to get some gas to go on into Atlanta so we can get mad at you.
So you, I guess that we told us, sir, talking about the summer of 64, that you were more battle fatigue.
Yeah.
That beating.
Yeah, that beating. I was just really out of it. And I was sort of despondent also because we had ordered, we had told Cheney, Goodman, and Sherman, who had talked to us prior to them leaving, coming to Mississippi. We'd asked them not to drive back to Mississippi together. We told them that it was dangerous and the time was not right for what they were fixing to do. And I had talked to Swinner myself and told him not to do it, begged him not to do it. Anyway, they left, came round through Greenwood, and then left here. So all of that had happened, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we had been over in Philadelphia, Mississippi, looking for their bodies and stuff. And we couldn't find anything. And then,
did you go down as part of the advance team?
Yeah.
There were three sellers and there were 10 of you that died.
Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't think it's never been brought out that those old people who were back up from where the church was burned told Dick Gregory and myself and somebody else. So now, if you want to find those fellows, you go over where the dam is. So those fellows are dead. Y'all stop looking for them. They're dead. You want to go find them, that's where they are. So now, we got our guns. So if anybody come up here, we're going to shoot first and ask questions later.
So this was the older black couple or something?
Old black couple.
That they?
They knew it.
Mm-hmm. Dick Gregory was part of that advance team?
Sure. Dick Gregory said, well, I'm going and asked Hugh Hefner for $10,000. And he said, you know, Whitey tried to bomb, put a bomb on the airplane, this has just happened, to blow up the airplane to collect insurance on his mama. So you know, if you say, put $10,000 on, a war on who tried to kill a little white boy or something like that, so he's going to tell him. That's where it all happened. So.
What did you think of the training sessions?
I was out of it. I didn't think of anything. Mm-hmm. I just knew it wasn't going to work. And when the McComb report that came out said that the civil rights movement had been infiltrated with CIA and his daughters and sons and all, that's when I began to get relief. Mm-hmm. Because I said, I told you. Mm-hmm. Peacock had drank himself into a pure alcoholic because of it.
Because of the Sun Project?
Mm-hmm. He would get so drunk he couldn't even stand up. It just almost destroyed him.
Before the summer? Or
right beginning that.
Mm-hmm.
During that time. Coming back, from training sessions. And in a way, too, I think they wanted us out. Because we just didn't see it working.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that all of the lights that were there to the destructive movement. A lot of them tried to do a lot of good. But you could tell who they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was that obvious.
Mm-hmm. appreciate it, almost.
I never respected him in the first place. It was one of his brainstorms. I think that Lawrence was probably one of the person who's responsible for part of the destruction of the movement. That's what I think.
With good motivations from the beginning or bad motivations from the beginning?
Perhaps somewhat good. In Genesis? Mm-hmm. Perhaps.
Mm-hmm. The,
where is Alma?
He's killed.
Oh, what?
You know that story?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Dennis Sweeney?
Mm-hmm.
Dennis, sometime in the early 70s, Dennis went from the movement to pretty active involvement, active in the anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
to a series of communes in California, to some serious drugs. Anyway, at some point, seems to have lost it completely and walked into Lonson's New York office in 81 in World War. Shot him 7 times, put the gun down at the secretary's desk and sat there with his. Dennis is now in a prison hospital in New York State.
Wow.
Why? Dennis, remember, do you know David Harris?
Mm-hmm.
David Harris has written a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there will be more. But instead, Dennis had gotten some dental work done in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably after that, Macomb Freedom House had gotten.
Yeah.
Anyway, in 73, he ripped his dental work out, claiming that there was a CIA transmitter in his dental work, which is beginnings of the end for him. But was convinced that Lowenstein was spying on him or CIA involved, or just paranoia had been on him. No one really knows. But yeah, there's also a homosexual motive that there's some talk. It's interesting because there is some evidence that Lowenstein did make a number of passes at.
So I saw him as a homosexual.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's very controversial. But Harris in his book relates 6 or 7 different people debated that. That Lowenstein made very, very subtle passes at people, including, and Harris said it happened to him. Himself, and there was some question that Sweeney was one of Lowenstein's proteges in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
or the very beginning, before we got to Mississippi. Anyway, so that's another very bizarre twist of all this. Let me ask you one other question, because I think it's fairly important. Bob Moses said in another interview that I read with Dave Dennis, we're talking about the post-Atlantic City period. Atlantic City had happened, and they both talked. David Dennis said to somebody recently, he said, "I just didn't know what to do." I just didn't know what to do, and Bob talked about it in the sense that. And he just didn't feel there was any program, that there was nothing, there was no way to sustain what they had. They had the beginnings of a political party, but they had no program, they had no, and it's almost like they both, what do we do? This is a question that, what was the way, was there a way out of that situation? What could have been done if you had it to do over, if you had history to do over?
Spend more time politicizing the people first. Mm-hmm. Like the people themselves were not as politically advanced themselves as to the point that they themselves were ready to even deal with that. And that was because of lack of leadership, lack of ourselves being at the level of political sophistication that we perhaps should have been at, and learning more about the issues and cause and organizing and dealing at that level than what we were. I don't think that we were ready because the homework, we weren't politicized to the point that we were ready to go and move from step 1, 2, 3, 4. There was no organization mm-hmm. at that level. So definitely, we didn't know what to
so
do.
One possible solution would be, again, something that Bob mentioned would have been that, I never really asked him the question if he had to do it over, but he talks about desire to have greater staff education.
That's correct. That's my point.
Mm-hmm. So you felt that that was something that was
absolutely,
lacking.
Totally lacking. Mm-hmm. There was none.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you got a leader for people, politicized to the point he knows exactly what he's going to do. He's educated to the point he knows what he's going to do. How in the world can you move people into doing things that you don't really know what should be doing right?
Is it Bob was saying that he thought that I mean, given that the summer had taken place, that he said the only thing that he could have seen as a way out of it would have been to try to use literacy, a literacy campaign, as the organizing tool, just as you had tried to use voter registration, as something that all the factions could have agreed on.
I think we should move more into an economic.
Wait, this is today or back then?
Back then.
Mm-hmm.
See, the problem all the time is economics.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us were hollering that at that point, but the timing wasn't right to move to that level.
Doesn't what you're saying, because it's exactly what you were just saying a few minutes ago, you needed to have staff education.
That's correct.
To get, I mean, economics would have been much more difficult than literacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about dealing more with economic issues
mm-hmm.
than anything else. And building programs, getting people into self-help programs and things where they can begin to see something that has, and deal with something that has some longevity to it,
mm-hmm.
that would give some support financially to them, you know, to help them become self-sufficient.
Well, is that completely different from if Moses is, what if you use literacy as the beginning point of that?
Well, you have to, yeah. It has to start there.
Right.
If you don't, then you ain't going to have a program in 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. What was the reaction among SNCC workers to Kennedy's death? What was your reaction?
I was angry with Kennedy anyway, because we had been begging the Kennedys for protection, and we weren't getting anything. I can only speak for myself, you know, my true feelings. But I didn't really feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's because of my anger.
Somebody said there was some discussion about you were in a conference shortly after that, or shortly, there was some discussion about whether or not to attend the funeral or send a message to the funeral.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't really think that we should be there.
Were there any people that felt that you should?
Not that I remember. We had called hell. And Kennedy was able to do something and didn't.
Mm-hmm. Was there a time when you didn't feel that way?
Sure.
You know when the turning point came?
Yes, when we learned that the only way we could really begin to get to change your mood is when we had to go through Martin Luther King.
When was that specific? Well, I mean, what are you referring to particularly?
what something happened. I forgot what the rest of it was. The Amsley had to call King. I've forgotten what it was, but the Amsley had to orchestrate something for King to have done.
And you resented the fact that he wouldn't talk to anyone in your organization, Jack. Mm-hmm. Is there, do you have a check-in at 4 o'clock or something? Or
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a home time. Okay. Another question. Sorry, this is so random, and I'm just trying to pick things. Some of people mentioned but couldn't put a focus on. There's an incident of a teenage pregnant girl being beaten in Greenwood. People were saying that they thought that was one of the, they thought the dogs, mm-hmm. and this teenage.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you remember the incident or when it might have happened or anything?
It happened it was during the march.
During a series of marches?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were getting ready to go to the courthouse. And it was just the day before, I think it was, the dog was sick on Tucker. That this happened, she was beaten.
Oh, so during one of the first marches?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you were there during some of the marches?
Sure.
Okay.
I was in and out.
Oh, when you weren't, when you weren't doing your fundraising?
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you weren't out there, so you were...
Yeah. I was in and out. Mm-hmm. They had me, kept me on the road. SNCC needed money then.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main fundraiser at the time.
What did you think of Gregory's role?
Very timely, very needed, helped one hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dick Gregory, a lot of other people came out of the woodworks, you know, like Harry Belafonte and Cindy Poitier.
Mm-hmm.
But Gregory was the first.
Yeah.
He was committed.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, has demonstrated that commitment, you know, from time then to, you know.
He really, he still seems to be,
yeah.
Or tell us in TV or something that seems to be nice.
One thing that has never been brought out that people don't know also is that the young lady who was in the car with us, that Captain Usher, had told that she would, you know, could kill any of these niggas, got pregnant by Peacock, and she had gone to register. Vote. And I had passed the registration there. And they ordered her to come back down to withdraw her names from the voter rolls. And she would. And they put a fraudulent food stamp charge on her and sent her to the Mississippi State Penitentiary for a year, year and a half, and she had the baby in the room. She had a choice. They told her to withdraw. She wouldn't.
If she took her name off?
She wouldn't. There are a lot of stories, you know, true stories, yet just to be told, you know. A lot of things that happened. I think that it's time for the people to know. Eventually, you know, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the reason why I said, you know, I want to know is because I think that people can learn.
Mm-hmm. The I had a chance to go talk to Vincent Harding.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's a Peacock and Moses are both heavily involved in yoga, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a look at their activity and you talk with someone like Vincent, who they talk about having a, let's say, the term that I guess Vincent would use, a spiritual engine.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think that Moses and Peacock, at least whatever you know, in terms of the same way. Bob talks a lot about how yoga allows you to create that sort of energy
mm-hmm.
inside you.
Mm-hmm.
As a way, if you take that concept and what Vincent was doing, he's talking about a way to not only have staff education, but staff
mm-hmm.
Creating energy within the staff,
mm-hmm.
recommitment, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought through, I mean, have you thought through the, how, I mean, how do you sustain a group of people like SNCC? Have you thought a lot about that? I mean, how do you...
If I would do it now, I didn't know that Peacock and Bob were into yoga. But I study some yoga myself now. And I'm more into transcendental meditation. And reading all the Swamis, you know, Swami Skachandana and all that, and into more of positive thinking, positive attitude, movement kind of thing, illusion to sustain myself. I would definitely recommend, you know, if we were, you know, together again as a SNCC family, that we would begin to look at transcendental meditation first, because I believe that if we were students of yoga or of transcendental meditation or of the art of positive thinking and dealing with self, I think that many of the problems that we found that we had within us, ourselves, and that came out in hostile ways toward each other, that caused hostility, a lot of problems with it. Not at all existed. It would have minimized a lot of the inner friction that we had to deal with, you know, being together, working together, getting on each other's nerves, not knowing how to handle that energy, you know, and not knowing how to channel it off, you know, to a different avenue, you know, where we can be comfortable with, you know, you know, not having to upset anybody or being upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it would have helped, yes.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I ask that is, I mean, I guess I've been interviewing folks for a couple years now, and I mean, there's two incredibly strong impressions that I've had. One is, outside of all the acts of heroism and everything, outside of all of that, it's an incredibly quality group of people. I mean, just strong, quality, good people. I mean, that are there. I mean, you should go down and spend time with Hollis. I mean, you know, you can't help but just think this is a good person. The second feeling I guess I've had is that the price has been enormous.
Mm-hmm. I'm still paying.
Divorces,
mm-hmm.
alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
early death.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree, Vincent Harding and Moses are reclusive. I mean, there's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while when I'm writing and I think about all this, I think in some ways, I do flashes where I feel like I'm being deceitful. When you talk about heroic acts.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe you're not telling people all the consequences of that. I mean, not just during the years,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, here's a whole history of all that, and I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and you.
It is difficult. Very difficult.
Lee Sellers said something that it should be a book title one day. He said, "There's no pension in the movement.
Yeah.
There's no retirement fund. There's no." I guess that was the thing that was most striking about Mrs. Palmer's visit was what Bob did essentially was just lay out Mrs. Palmer's early life, or allow her the opportunity to lay out her early life, lay out the movement. But then it was clear to the people, it was clear to the students who really didn't understand all this, that, I mean, from 1970 on, Mrs. Palmer's life reverted back to the 50s, and she's now... She runs this little, or she was running a small little, you know, washerette.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think there was enormous things. One was enormous possibility that lies within people that allows someone like Mrs. Palmer to become energized to that point. But then for her to do that, and then there was nothing there after 70 or after, I mean, after she went through the whole cycle with earnest goodwill. I mean, the poverty programs and everything. And then it was all of a sudden, it was just like, I'm poor again.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
That's my point. That is my point. It hurt a million people. Destroyed a million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly my point. And it's enlightening to hear you say that and know that Bob, you know, sees that also, man.
You know, it's funny because in some ways, Hollis is the of all the people I've met. I mean, Hollis was so nice to me. He opened a lot of doors for me when I was in Mississippi, and he told me a lot of stuff, and basically encouraged me when I had a time when I needed encouragement. And so he's become, like, not my favorite, but, you know, I've really grown to care for him. He probably doesn't even know that. But but then I was thinking, and I was thinking, one of the reasons I probably feel that way is because, in some ways, Hollis is the most intact.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he did go through a divorce, but, and then I realized that that was part of my thinking, and I started to think about everyone that I had met, to some degree, was still paying the price. I mean, yours is a lot more visible.
Yeah.
You know, here I am. But at the same time, I see everybody searching for not only opportunities to continue to do things, but I guess one of the reasons I'm interested in that question is how do you sustain people? You know, how do you find the engine that will allow people, so that the burnout isn't there to quite the same degree?
There are several ways. One, people, first of all, should not be made to spend the kind of ongoing time in a movement, you know, 24 hours, 25 hours a day, 7 days a week. Automatically, that number one is going to burn me out. But over the period of time, you know, quarters, you work 3 months, you go to a retreat for 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, or a month, or something, and you come back. Don't let the movement be built around you, number two. Get community people more involved in rolling and handling the ball in the genesis, where they won't have to depend on you. That's number two. And number three is to have a viable program where people are going to benefit from it economically as well as humanistically. Mm-hmm. And much of that has been missing. And you can't sustain, you just can't expect the same person to continue to go on and on and on in life without being forced at some point to become battered again.
Mm-hmm.
And just give up for a moment. See, I don't mind people giving out for a moment, but I do mind them giving up. See, you're giving out, you can always go back and regroup.
Mm-hmm.
But people are forced to the point, were forced to the point in the movement where they had to give up instead of giving. And there's no kind of built-in organizational glue that we could use to sustain ourselves to deal with exactly what you can show us. There's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's nothing, you're forced to become another Miss Palmer. And then you don't just have a heart attack. It takes its toll.
Mm-hmm.
It destroys you.
Mm-hmm.
You become another Palmer. And man's brilliance bothers you.